Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, and our guest today, David Anderson, who is the author of the book Faithless to Fearless, The Event That Changed the World, available at shop.1517.com and on Amazon, and there's probably some other channels too. I'll fill it up with links.
Shop.1517
is .org. Ooh, .org. I messed it up. Shop.1517.org. You can check it out. It's apologetic work, which gets us to the introduction of the show. We're in a multi-week series on apologetics, and this is a middle episode. So to catch Dave up, we did two introductory episodes to apologetics, and now we're going to start doing where I sent out a blast for listener questions on apologetics because we did a 20-something episode series on apologetics in our first year. And we covered a bunch of topics, and this time I thought we'd go through maybe some of those exact same topics, but from the angle of a way somebody from the outside would be asking the question, yeah, rather than the way we would just sort of do it on paper. So that's what we're going to be doing in the upcoming weeks, but in between that, we're going to talk about this book, the content of this book, because I thought it was interesting. So people can go ahead and check that out. The other thing to keep note for this episode is we have two Christ Hold Fast City events coming up soon. We have one in Houston and one in Las Vegas. You can sign up for those at the 1517 website. I'll put the link in the show notes. 1517.org/events is how you can get there directly. But again, I'll put the link in the show notes so you can go there and you can check those events out. If you live in Southern California, Las Vegas is not a horrible drive. So that might be worth it, especially if you live like in the high desert in the Inland Empire, then it's really not that long of a drive if you're listening to the show. And Adam, are you going to be in Vegas?
Yes.
So Adam's in Vegas.
Every weekend.
Scott's in Vegas. That's...
Just kidding. I have no idea what to do in Vegas.
Oh, we'll show you.
I once graded papers at a bachelor party. While they're all out doing whatever people do in Vegas, I was grading papers.
Last yeah. time,
Caleb, a nerd I am.
Caleb and I were there. We went and shot automatic rifles.
Yeah, we did. Ooh, we got to. Yeah, yeah, there's a.
Now you're talking.
A small range inside.
Where that was pretty fun.
That was pretty fun.
Never had the urge to shoot an automatic weapon.
I didn't really have the urge either, but it was offered. So.
Yep. I understand.
Yep. Yep. So I think let's see. We did the book, the event. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything else. If I am, I'll put it in the show notes. Just look at the top half of the show notes there. We're also in, I've been asking people week after week to help us bump up the amount of reviews we have on the Thinking Fellows podcast. We're at pretty close to 500 reviews, maybe at the time after this recording, over 500, hard to tell. But if you haven't done that yet, great opportunity to pause this episode, go into the review section of Apple Podcasts and go review it and then come back. Again, you know, the immediate goal is 500, and I think we can, I honestly believe we can hit the goal of 1,000 this year. We have significantly more listeners than that, so it would just take some people who don't listen on Apple Podcasts going over there and reviewing, and I've been putting the link in the show notes. So even if you listen on Android or you use some other application, it'd be great to get that review. It helps bump us up in the search results, not just on Apple Podcasts, but in the directory of almost every podcasting app out there. So that would be really worthwhile for us. Okay, guys, let's get into this episode. So, Dave, could you give us a little bit of your background, what you do for a living? You know, everybody on the show is a professor, a theologian, or something like that. Could you tell people where you're coming from now?
You're not a professor.
I am
or theologian or something of that stripe.
Yeah, I was a professor. I taught in the Concordia system for a few years and other places in the Midwest. But my crushing student loan debt for my PhD required me to get a real job, unfortunately. And as Aristotle says, philosophy bakes no bread. So
it needs to be a sticker.
Yeah. So
I'm on it.
a family member of mine and I started a software company, and that's what I've been doing ever since. And part of what influenced me to look at how humans behave, quite frankly, is by watching various organizations and how employees behave, how people behave, why they're so resistant to change. And that's what led me into some of the research of Kahneman and a lot of others. And the interesting part about it is human nature being what it is, we see exactly the same behavior in the disciples. It's all right there in the text. And again, those are things that even skeptical scholars accept as historical because they fit the criterion of embarrassment. The early church would not have made up embarrassing details about the disciples, and certainly not deliberately. And it's all there. There's a lot of embarrassing material in there about the disciples. I mean, there are dumb questions, which I see myself in them. You see Cleopas on the road to Emmaus, who's telling Jesus, who he doesn't know is Jesus, at the time that we were hoping that he would be the one to restore Israel. And so they held on to those ideas, those deeply embedded Jewish ideas, even after that point. And in no way did they expect a resurrection. So a lot of my business background was fodder for this book.
Oh, cool. Well, let's jump into the first chapter, and then we'll go from there. Chapter one starts with context, like the background story of your life and how you got introduced to Christian apologetics. I thought this was pretty helpful because when we talk to people on the show, or try to talk to people on the show, we try to really include this idea that you have to listen to where somebody's at. It's not just about giving them the facts as you've memorized them about an event. So it seemed appropriate to me that you started the book. But why did you start with your own story, and how does that progress sort of the outlook on apologetics as you did it?
Well, number one, because I wanted people to know why I'm asking the questions I'm asking. A lot of books are written, and you kind of wonder what their assumptions are, and I wanted to just lay those bare. Number two, this was written for my children, and so I wanted them to have a record of where I came from and why I ask the questions I do, and why I've come to the position I do. So that's really where that chapter came from.
So will you give people an insight here? I think it's pretty interesting. So the book starts off with you as a young Mormon in Utah?
Yep. I was born and raised, actually, in a very committed Mormon family. Matter of fact, I'm still about the only non-Mormon member of my family. So I was born and raised that way, and believed it with everything I had up until the time I was probably 16 or 17. And somebody, a friend of mine, started suggesting some other reading material on Mormon leaders. And I started reading those and realized, you know, these guys they're not who I was taught. And they have some ghosts in their past and some crazy ideas, and that's kind of what catalyzed or just pushed me out of the faith.
So some like investigative questions?
Yeah. So what do you mean?
Like looking at the sources of what you believed in, where it was coming from?
Yeah, so there have been some books that have been written by a lot of people, actually. Walter Martin was one of them, and I went and, you know, worked for Walter Martin when I was about 20 years old, and actually it was Martin's organization that sent me to Christ College, to you, Rod. thank God for that. But there are a lot of people have written and just reproduced the documents of the early Mormon founders and what they actually wrote, and I wasn't taught that as a young Mormon person, and it really just shed light on who these guys really were and what they really believed, and it's just still seems crazy to me.
It's like Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and those characters.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're talking about the founders.
Mm-hmm. And in the book, it's been a little while, but I've read it about two or three.
Yeah,
times.
I think Adam's Kung read it probably more than anybody.
There was something about Kung Fu, a Kung Fu instructor who kind of was it a Kung it Fu instructor an,
yeah,
who
yeah.
kind of put.
It was an
pushed
odd
you in a direction.
Yeah, it was an odd thing. I was heavily involved in martial arts for the good portion of my teenage years, and one of my kung fu instructors happened to have been a Christian, and he said, "You know, you probably ought to take a look at the evidence for the physical resurrection of Jesus." And I did, and it was convincing to me.
Well, that's kind of funny because, anecdotally, it sort of proves the point we've been trying to make on here for a while, that you need to, like, that's where you need to drive people, right? Like, not diving through the weeds, but sort of get to the point of the issue, did Christ raise from the dead or not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the name of the first title is Where I'm Coming From.
Yeah.
Which, do you propose then that it's important for us to understand where, like, even as Christians, where we're coming from before we engage in these apologetic conversations? Like, at what level does this idea of understanding one's past affect the apologetic task?
The reason I put it in there is because I wanted to make clear why I think that these conversations need to be based on what we know to be true rather than what we feel is true, because I was raised as obviously as a Mormon who believed that truth is known by what they call the burning in the bosom. It's a subjective feeling, and because I was raised that way, I react rather violently against any of the similar ideas that even come from Christians who view Christianity from a subjective standpoint. Mm-hmm. So the reason I wanted to put that in is just to let the reader know, and to let my children know, that we've got to base it on what we know to be the case rather than what we want to believe.
So we talk about this all the time on the show. When I was at Concordia full-time, one of the classes I taught was just the Intro to Christianity course, which means you get everybody in there. So it doesn't matter what degree they're going for, everybody at the university takes, you know, the Intro to Theology course, New Testament and Old Testament, and so you'll have every recruited athlete, you'll have every business major, every art major goes through there. And what that means is that when you're, and what you're supposed to teach is a very, I'd say, formal, right? It's, you're basically doing formal Christian doctrine, just a real rudimentary version of it from a Lutheran perspective. And in that class, you have, you know, maybe 15% of the students are Christian, maybe 8 to 9% are Lutheran, and of the 8 to 9% are Lutheran, maybe, you know, only 75% of those have had formal catechesis and have ever experienced anything like what we're doing in that class. And so I've always started out that course with just this series of lectures on what do you believe and why do you believe it. Because that framework exists for everybody in some way, shape, or form. Now, a lot of it's subjective, like you said, right? A lot of things that people hold to be very true and very important to them, they hold for subjective reasons. But it's at least good at the beginning of a class like that to flesh it out before you start getting into, like, what we would say are objective Christian doctrines and objective truth statements. One of the challenges that I've even found, and Adam and I have talked about this a lot in teaching, because we get asked, and Adam just came back from a gig doing this, we get asked to go out and teach people at congregations how to do apologetics. And so it's very easy to sort of jump into, well, this is how you answer objections. But what's very helpful is to actually kind of take a step back and sort of formally do how do you help people examine why it is they believe the things that they do, or even help them examine what it is they actually believe. Because this is just such a crapshoot in our day and age. I mean, you don't have to be Mormon to have a whole set of values that are based on a burning in the bosom.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I've been part of a couple of CEO groups, and it's interesting because a lot of the guys that I've known are really, really atheist. I mean, almost religiously atheist. Mm. And so part of what goes on in this book was influenced by my listening to them talk about the fact that God can't exist. And so I wanted to really go after the facts that everybody agrees on. And that's why I use the minimal facts approach, which basically takes a core group of facts that Christians and atheists and agnostics agree on, that scholars agree on, that we can all use as a common basis and say, look, whatever theory you have about what happened to the disciples shortly after Jesus' crucifixion, it has to at least account for the minimal facts that we all agree on.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
yeah. Wise. Wise.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good approach. It's Habermas and Michael Lacona. They're the ones that have really done a lot of work on this. So obviously we're indebted to them for that. And Michael Lacona's more extensive work was really helpful for my own work.
I just think what you've done by sort of laying out your presuppositions, I guess I'd say, is helpful, because it, in a modern conversation, you know, where I guess I'd say the qualifications of modernity aren't, you know, a constant, right? Sort of the things that we don't all come into life assuming the same things anymore, ethically, just truth statements, the whole nine yards. But laying out where you're starting is helpful. And even with, I'd say, younger adults in our age, it's helpful for two reasons. One, because it encourages them to sort of do the same thing. And two, it's honest. And that kind of honesty, or as they say it these days, quote unquote, authenticity, mm-hmm. Is very valued. So to start out a book of apologetics, especially for your children, right? By doing that, I think it's a helpful approach, because you have to sort of show your cards.
Right.
And mm-hmm. these days.
And the other thing that I've done here, and I put a little work into the research on some of the flawed ways that we tend to think, and controlling those biases that we tend to bring to emotionally charged subjects like the existence of God and Christianity. They have to be accounted for and controlled. We have to realize that they're there and deal with them as they come up.
One of the things with the book, at least this was for me, that section on epistemology and the way people think is, I found myself going to Amazon ordering all these books. I'd never heard of these business type books, Thinking Fast and Slow and others. I think I told you on the phone once that I probably spent about $100 buying all these new books. I can learn more.
Sorry, Adam.
They're all in a stack still. I haven't opened.
You're still thinking slow? You haven't read them yet?
Yeah, right. Yeah, Daniel Kahneman has done a lot of work on this, and it's fascinating the data that the research has gathered. It's universal.
We talk about epistemology a lot on the show. It's probably our third, our third favorite set of topics. Which tells you where we think it sort of ranks.
It tells you why we're so popular.
Yeah. and one of the... I liked the way I think it was put was that we tend to think we're really scientific. Like, right. Objectively. And we tend...
By we, who are you speaking of?
Like the Western world.
Okay, gotcha. I think I am. Yeah. But.
But so does everybody else. Right. And at some level that... seems to break down in the way we actually process information. Could you outline that? Because I thought it was one of the pretty clever pieces in here.
So a lot of the research a lot of it has come from Kahneman. He shows by a lot of data, experimental data, that we have two systems of thinking. System one is a very gullible system. It's rather instantaneous. We tend to believe the first thing we hear. Mm. And this has been shown over and over and over again, from everything in negotiations to even real estate prices. The first thing we hear provides an anchor. And it's very difficult to dislodge the first thing we hear. People will hang on to things when they're not true. Even when they've heard the correction, they will still hang on to it.
I might know somebody who does that pretty well. I might be married.
I was going to say, when I sold cars, we manipulated this fact in people. Not me specifically, but the dealership that I worked for did what was called addendum pricing on the vehicles, because they were supposedly a high demand type of vehicle for the area and there was low supply. So they would literally print out a new piece of paper over the MSRP sticker that had an additional $2,000 addendum, mm-hmm. which was literally, as an insider there, was literally just negotiating room, because most people would then negotiate down to MSRP. And because they were under the impression.
Adam's sitting here going, that's what I did.
And all you had to say was, look, you can go online and you can see that the cars are selling for cheaper in other areas, but that's not here in this particular geographic area.
Yeah, and this has been shown. I mean, this has been shown all over the place, but in any negotiation, you want to be the first to set
the number,
set a price.
Yeah.
Because the it'll inevitably end up somewhere around the price that you have anchored in the person's mind.
Anybody who's watched Pawn Stars knows that.
By the way, insider information, if you go to a car lot as a Thinky Fellows listener and you see an addendum price, totally disregard that. That's just negotiating room.
Good grief.
Car dealership. Somebody works at a car dealership and is listening to this right now and going, stop.
Yeah.
One of the things that this makes me think of is just how, political discourse, you know, just how powerful narratives are.
I was thinking that too.
And they know it too. And they know it. Yeah. They know how to manipulate.
I mean, lately I've been thinking about, you know, all these claims of systemic racism and so on and so forth. What happens if you're not being coached by a narrative? You know, you put down your phone and you just go about your normal, like, natural life. Will you experience those things? And if you don't experience those things, does that then when you encounter the claim that everything's racist everywhere, do you question that? And your books suggest that you hang on to that, despite the facts.
Exactly.
And so in my work with Islam, I encounter that all the time, this sort of rigid ideological thinking where something's true or presumed to be true regardless of the facts. It's like what, I think it was said of either Hegel or Kant, when somebody questioned, I think it was Hegel, his approach to, or his outlining of how history drives forward. And a young girl says, well, Professor Hegel, that's a nice theory, but it doesn't fit the facts. And he says, the facts be damned.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. I mean, that
the story is told a lot. I think it's apocryphal, but it gets it across.
I hope it's true, though. It might not be true. But
it would take a German
who cares what the facts
that.
Are here.
Yeah.
But you encounter that. It's in, I mean, I think somebody said earlier, amidst Christians, this sort of we call it fideism, usually in our, this trust or faith in what you think is true in the first place, regardless of whether the facts correspond to that or not.
Don't you think that's maybe one of the helpful, rake me over the coals for this, but one of the helpful things about postmodernism is sort of the realization that everybody does have a narrative that it may or may not be consistent with the outside world, but that people are operating within a particular literary idea about themselves and where they came from, and that.
I think if you sort of take that further and say one of the helpful things can be sort of the insistence that everybody reveal what their narrative is,
and sure.
Maybe said a better way, that the insistence that everybody reveal their presuppositions.
Yeah.
You know, before we enter, I think that is helpful. The problem that I think extends as you take postmodernism farther is the desire to then deconstruct everyone's.
Absolutely.
That there is no truth at that point.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
If the end goal were honorable.
Clarification.
Yeah, honorable, in that they want to know your presuppositions for clarification so we can have a discussion, that's
sure.
A good thing.
Sure.
But more likely than not, it's let's know your presuppositions so we can tear them apart.
Yep.
Yeah, and I don't say it in the book, but I think the method I'm really adopting here is that of critical realism.
Sure.
Where it's a recognition of, there's a world out there, and we can know it.
Right.
We do know it.
Yep.
But we also bring a lot to that act of knowing, and we have to correct
that. Let me throw in something that has to do with the theological world that I don't think many of our people think about. I was in seminary my first year at a pretty liberal Lutheran place. There were 70 of us in the class. Two of us were natural science majors, me and a guy from Duke who was a doctor's son too. We had a completely different set of questions than all of the guys who had history majors, any other kind in the humanities than we had. And that feeling that I was an oddball for asking the sort of questions I was asking, I never forgot. Mm-hmm. That I was out of water, or a fish out of water in my own field that I was beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank God for that.
So do we, Rod. I think everybody around this table can attest to that.
I think it probably makes, and I would guess, Adam's stomach turn that the historian, his history students weren't asking similar questions.
Yeah.
I mean, because practicing a science of a sort, too, that
yes,
sort of
should be
asks yeah. for the same sort of evidential proof or argumentation or evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And when that doesn't happen, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest barriers. You were talking about sort of science, I guess I'd call it scientism of our age or scientificism or whatever of our age, is that it's false. You know, if it were, it's a set of presuppositions that aren't actually based on evidence, that are based on the first thing somebody heard
yep.
from a teacher in a in a class that the teacher may or may not even be qualified to teach.
Yep.
And that's held on to, and because it was put out as, well, science tells us, now that's science, whether it's actually science or not.
Right.
And I think it's just destructive.
Well, yeah.
And it makes people, even in those fields, not ask the right question.
Right.
And then in other fields that should have, you know, a scientific or quasi-scientific approach to them, say history, not ask the same questions. You know, what is the evidence for this statement? What is the evidence for that? Why do we believe this? What can we rally in support of our belief that sure. this actually occurred the way we believe it occurred?
Yep.
That doesn't happen because, you know, there's these authorities out there and you believe the first thing they hear. I would guess that's one of the other things. There is this sort of appeal to authority that is just rampant in our day.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, the objectivism can be manipulated because you talk about people, it's necessary that people form theories about things they believe or do in their lives. And that word, you can then cling to it as being a one-to-one correspondence with the more mechanical idea of theory in the scientific realm.
Exactly.
Which I've actively seen manipulated in people because they have a working definition of theory that then gets applied to these actually more subjective
right.
things.
Right.
I think these days you meet more scientists who are mechanics than scientists that are scientists.
And yes.
It's Adam and I were working on my daughter's van a while ago trying to figure out why, what would you call the steering? It's a
slop in the steering wheel.
Yeah. And so, but it's a process of elimination, right? We don't know. It's a practice. So we'd try, you know, new shocks, see if that helps. That doesn't help. We try
and
new
drink
springs.
Drink beer and then
drink
try
beer
something else.
See if that helps.
Sure. Yeah.
Put on
sure.
a steering stabilizer, see if that helps. Maybe you go to the steering box, see if that helps. You know,
yep.
and it's empirical, you know?
Yep.
And
right. Yep.
That's what's gone.
Yeah.
Yep. So one of the great things about the book that kind of sets it apart from a lot of other more evidential approaches is, I would say, how prudential you are. You approach the evidence very cautiously, and you don't overstate things throughout. I mean, just to put a plug in for the book is just how cautious he moves forward. I think you guys have at least skimmed it, right? It just came out
this morning.
Just it's tedious in the best sense of the word. I mean, you're like, oh, okay, and you're just leading.
My wife says
through.
I'm tedious in the worst sense.
Well, no, this is. I mean, for a guy who likes,
I've only known you for 2 days, and I'd concur.
For a historian who wants to be very cautious, I mean, it's the
we kind of
that minimal facts approach.
Yeah,
and going through the facts and considering what we might call counter arguments, mm-hmm. and I mean, the what is it? Two chapters where you go into oral transmission. I can't remember.
I
now,
do have a, yeah, I've got
just
a chapter on oral.
So that. Slow and cautious. I loved it. I mean, that's when you turned in the manuscript. I don't know, how long did it take us to turn it around? Like a day or something? Yeah, we should publish this. And I think it is a tremendous contribution to apologetics alongside the works of Habermas and Lacuna. But it's also different than their approach as well.
Yeah, it is. It is.
With the section, the beginning section on epistemology and the way people think. And then when you get to the end, though, you make, if I remember correctly, you say something about, in your appendix, as well as the conclusion of the book, about how it's important, or you describe how it's important to have a view of the world and the things that happen in the world that corresponds to the facts.
Mm-hmm.
What would you don't give a percentage to it because that would be a little odd for this text, but what would you say in terms, if you look at all the facts surrounding the resurrection of Jesus, where are we in terms of its probability? I know Richard Swinburne said it was pretty high. He put it in the high 90s, I think, in one of his
works. And Swinburne's no dummy.
He's no dummy. I would put it at the high 90s as well. Yeah. And part of that is because it's not just the minimal facts that we're aware of and we have to account for, but it's the fact that the disciples in no way, shape, or form would have picked a crucified man as a Messiah.
Mm.
It would have been the dumbest thing they could have ever done.
Yep.
They had no concept of a Messiah rising again before the end of time, and they had no concept of the Messiah and its connection to Yahweh, the Old Testament God of Israel. Mm. So all of those elements came together like an explosion, like a Big Bang explosion. That too has to be explained. Mm. That is, those are facts that even skeptical scholars agree that Jesus was regarded as curious from the very beginning. I mean, by the time Paul starts writing his letters, those beliefs about Jesus are settled.
Mm. Yeah.
This is only 20 years, right, after the crucifixion. That is an incredible pace of development. And we have every reason to believe that those beliefs were set within the first 3 to 5 years at the latest after the crucifixion.
You know, one of the ones I think about, it's oblique and tangential, but still I notice it whenever I read it. Just before his ascension, one of them says, "Lord, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel now?"
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really?
Even after all that time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Can you
just see him doing the face smack?
Yeah. Yeah.
Shaking his head.
Yeah.
I can see me asking the question. Yeah. That's what worries me.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I said over this weekend when I was doing this apologetic thing in Chicago, I said some statement to the fact that there is no real evidence to the contrary of Jesus' resurrection. Like, if you're going to order your explanation of the empty tomb, all the evidence, with the exception of the story you get in Matthew, or the account in Matthew where the tomb guards are paid off to circulate the story that the disciples stole the body, there is no other evidence that works against it.
So, well, not even that works against it, because that presupposes the empty tomb.
Yeah,
right?
They
couldn't deny that the tomb was empty, and that's why they came up with the story, obviously, that Jesus' disciples stole the body. So that's a significant fact.
Mm, yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Kind of moving forward a little bit, what do you think, is it the reason why people reject the explanation for the empty tomb is accounted by Jesus' resurrection? What do you think it is? Is it just presuppositions, a person's assumptions of?
I think one of the ones in our day were so self-centered. I think one of the ones that they can see in the blurry future if they say yes to it is, I don't own my own decisions. Somebody else is Lord over me, and I ain't going there.
Hmm.
I think that there's something to that.
Although they're tending to vote for more and more lordship over them every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. To answer that question, I think that naturalism is a very alluring position. The position that says that there is nothing outside of flesh and blood and that sort of thing. I think, in my opinion, a lot of it is pushed by naturalism. But the most popular theory there is, I think the one that people hold to the most, is the hallucination theory. Mass hallucination. But Habermas has done a just phenomenal job of dispelling that. There is no peer-reviewed literature that gives it any support whatsoever.
Yeah. It'd be a miracle if 500 plus people had the same hallucination.
It would be,
I think you have just mass amounts of people that are told from a very early age that the whole thing's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't say naturalism plays a part in that the people that are teaching them that are probably hard naturalists.
Yeah.
But for the sort of just average, say, university student that I've met that doesn't believe it, it's just that they've been told.
Mm-hmm.
you know,
that it's a myth and yeah, not even a cleverly devised one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. We, I mean, again, I hate to keep bringing him up since she broke up with him, but maybe that's why I'll bring him up. But Autumn's ex-boyfriend, you know, he comes into the house and he's got literally one semester at a community college in biology. One semester. Okay. And he comes to Caleb's house and has all sorts of these sort of just pat objections to Christianity. This kid was raised Christian. His first bachelor's degree is from a Bible college.
Ugh.
You know, one semester at a community college with a somewhat clever biology prof, and he's now saying, you know, extraordinary events requires extraordinary evidence. He's saying that I won't believe in the myth of Bronze Age peasants and all this other crap that is just, and he just
matters of faith and matter of fact are separate.
Just eats it up, right? And that's it. And I think that's it. If you can actually get somebody to want to consider facts about anything, right, and evidence about anything. Because that's really hard these days.
Yes.
I mean, look at the evidence for why you shouldn't make this stupid decision in your life, and then look at the evidence for the resurrection. But, you know, to get people to look at evidence is difficult. But if you can get them to look at it, honestly, I've just personally found that the objection doesn't stay if you can get them to the point where they're willing to just consider the idea that a person ought to be able to, you know, give evidence for any position that they hold.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
I don't know. I keep getting back to that, but it's just...
Well, you know the one I think of in this discussion? Think of where Bart Ehrman did his college work.
Moody
Bible Institute. Oh,
that explains a lot. I didn't know that.
Yep. I didn't know that either.
That's funny.
Yep.
And I mean, special thanks to all the listeners who prayed that they break up, because they did. So. I'm getting in real trouble with my family on this episode.
You know, be quiet. Yeah, you're lucky. You've pretty much covered the ground.
Yeah.
You're lucky none of them listen, huh?
Mom listens occasionally.
Oh no. I was thinking about, as you were talking about, sort of the ridiculousness of like attaching Christ to the God of the Old Testament and sort of the religious implications of the resurrection here, that there is still work to do past the bare facts in attaching the meaning of what it means for Christ to have lived, died, and risen.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot hanging there, too. So you can get, which I think is where some of the alternate explanations for the resurrection come, right? Because there are some actually religious things hanging on it still too, but that's actually not to a discount. It actually then explains the purpose of the Old Testament, those writings, sure. Why a death and resurrection mattered. If somebody's sort of laughing at the entire scheme of Christianity that a death could do something, there's still some interpretation and preaching to be done here, right, concerning these
sure.
facts.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So I think that's one of the other things we've been trying to get back to on this series on apologetics here, is that this isn't just about sort of winning fights, but if it really is about delivering Christ crucified over mm-hmm. to people, the facts are a tool to get past a barrier,
yep.
a particular barrier which stops people from hearing this interpretation about those facts. In fact, this proclamation concerning those facts that your sins are forgiven on account of these things.
Right, right.
And right. so, and that's sort of actually the important role that, like why we go to church and things like that, and why this isn't separate, is because that proclamation is so packaged into the fact that this happened, that this isn't a figment of our imagination or simply a story that we've
it's what Peter,
passed down.
It's what Peter wrote. I mean, some of these things are straight out of Scripture. Mm-hmm. We've not followed cunningly devised mythos when we made known to you the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We were eyewitnesses of his majesty, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which is probably a reference to the transformation. Hmm? Moses and Elijah talking with him.
Mm. Yeah.
And him asking really smart questions.
Are we getting yeah. to the close?
Or we're close them? Enough, but you can keep asking questions.
In doing all the research for the book, did you find... did it strengthen your resolve, or were there areas where you think, oh, I probably need to look a little more deeply there? Or, I mean,
No, for me, it strengthened my resolve, particularly, quite honestly, particularly in the section on the oral part, right? That was an interesting section to write. So you have roughly 18 to 20 years between the crucifixion and when our first Christian writings start to appear. And so the natural question is, well, what was going on during that 18 to 20 year?
Yeah.
But by the way, I mean, that's
a really
think that's
gap.
A long time, but it's actually lightning fast compared to other, compared to other.
It may seem like a long time in our age of texting and media information,
but it is
in
really
of,
short.
It's really short. Yeah.
But given the cost of even producing documents like this in the ancient world.
But the care that the ancient world went. I mean, they put a lot of time into making sure that things were transmitted, even by word of mouth, correctly. And
when texts were tested against the transmission of those traditions, is the other part of this.
Right.
In fact, it was so, like, the gospel as being handed down from the apostles was so significant that when false texts arrive, you can dismiss them by virtue of the spoken gospel.
Exactly. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah. So sometimes I think people are a little cautious with apologetics because they worry that it opens up Pandora's box.
Because
it turns you into a skeptic. You
know, many Christians are frightened to death they're going to make matters worse.
Yeah.
They're going to get cornered, and the hearer's condition they'll have lost ground to them instead of gaining it. Nothing could be further from the truth. The basic enterprise... I've mentioned this before. There are about 6 to 9 questions that are asked over and over and over and over and over. You get familiar with about 6 to 8 questions and feel comfortable, and you'll have covered 90% of your conversations.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I mean, we're dead at time unless somebody has something to add or another question to go. You know, again, Faithless to Fearless, the event that changed the world. I'll have the link in the show notes, both available on Amazon and on our shop. And you know what? The first person to email me and share the review that they went and wrote for this episode, I will send a free copy.
Why don't you say the first
of that
five,
book?
First five people.
I'll do that. First five people who email me proof, so like a screenshot of your recently published review on iTunes. Free book.
Ooh.
There we go.
You're paying for it?
Yeah, out of pocket.
Okay. It's not coming out of publishing's budget, right?
It's coming straight out of publishing's budget. Don't be a miser. This is called marketing, Adam. Again, hey, thank you for listening to this episode. If this episode prompted any questions or comments, you can go ahead and send them my way. I'll either answer them or direct them where need be. Again, we appreciate your help, both for people who have gone in, you know, giving us a rating and a review on the show, which help us in the search, but also those financial supporters who help 1517 and the Thinking Fellows by giving affordable monthly recurring donations. Really appreciate it, helping us reach our goal in 2019 and our future goals this 2020. So thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.